might do. Beside him were his fruits, a stalk or two of broccoli, a jar of peanut butter, the essays and other souvenirs, all neatly packed in a small cardboard box. On the desk, next to his notebooks, were a pocket flashlight, a hand mirror, and a list of questions from Dr. Flynn. All six of the lower ward cats were lying asleep on the bed. I asked him whether he minded my looking over the answers he had formulated to those 50 queries. Without interrupting his writing, he shook his head and waved me into the other chair. Some of the technical questions, for example, about nuclear energy, he had left unanswered, for reasons he had made clear in several of our sessions together. The last item was a request for a list of all the planets Prote had visited around the universe, to which he had replied, "See appendix," which tallied the complete list of 64. This inventory included a brief description of those bodies and their inhabitants, as well as a series of star charts. It was not everything Professor Flynn and his colleagues, including Steve, had hoped for, but enough to keep them busy for some time, no doubt. At around 3:10, he threw down his pencil, yawned, and stretched, for all the world as if he had just finished a routine piece of work. "May I see it?"
"Why not? But if you want to read it, you'd better make a copy right away. It's the only one I've got."
I called one of the night nurses to take it upstairs, admonishing him to get some help and to use all the copiers that were operational. He hurried off, clutching the little notebooks as though they were so many eggs. The possibility of stalling the process occurred to me at that point, but it might well have made matters even worse, and I quickly rejected the idea. I had a feeling the report would be a rather uncomplimentary account of Prote's visit to Earth, and I asked him, "Is there anything about our planet that you liked, besides our fruits, I mean?"
"Sure," he said with an all-too-familiar grin. "Everything but the people, with one or two exceptions, of course."
There didn't seem to be much left to say. I thanked my amazing friend for the many interesting discussions and for his success with some of the other patients. In return, he thanked me for all the wonderful produce and presented me with a gossamer thread. I pretended to take it. "I'm sorry to see you go," I said, shaking his brawny hand, though I wanted to hug him. "I owe you a lot, too."
"Thank you. I will miss this place. It has great potential."
At the time, I thought he was referring to the hospital, but of course he meant the Earth. The nurse came running back with a copy a few minutes before it was time for Prote to leave. I returned the original notebooks, a little jumbled but intact, to Prote.
"Just in the nick of time," he said. "But now you'll have to leave the room. Any being within a few feet will be swept along with me. Better take them with you, too," he said, indicating the cats.
I decided to humor him. Well, why not? There wasn't a damn thing I could do about it anyway. I rousted the cats from his bed. One by one, they brushed against his leg and streaked for various other warm places. "Goodbye, Sojourner Porter," I said. "Don't get knocked over by any apps."
"Not goodbye, just auf Wiedersehen. I'll be back before you know it."
He pointed toward the sky.
"After all, K-Pax isn't so far away, really."
I stepped out of the room but left the door open. I had already notified the infirmary staff to stand by, to be prepared for anything. I could see Dr. Chakraborty down the corridor with an emergency cart containing a respirator and all the rest. There were only a couple of minutes to go. The last I saw of Prote, he was sitting at his desk, tapping his report into a neater stack, checking his flashlight. He placed his box of fruit and other souvenirs on his lap, picked up his little mirror and gazed into it. Then he transferred the flashlight to his shoulder. At that moment, one of the security guards came puffing up to tell me that I had an urgent long-distance call. It was Robert's mother. At exactly the same instant, Chuck came running down the hall with his worn little suitcase, demanding to be taken aboard. Even with all this commotion, I couldn't have taken my eyes off Prote for more than a couple of seconds. But when I turned to tell him about the phone call, he was already gone. We all raced into the room. The only trace of him left behind were his dark glasses lying on a scribbled message. I won't be needing these for a while, the note said. Please keep them for me. Acting on my earlier hunch that Prout had hidden out in the storage tunnel during the few days he had allegedly gone to Canada, Greenland, and Iceland, we rushed to that area. The door was locked, and the security guard had some difficulty finding the right key. We waited patiently. I was confident we would find Prout there, until he finally got the heavy door open and found the light switch. There was enough dusty old equipment to start our own museum, but there was no sign of Prout. Nor was he hiding in the surgical theater or the seminar room, or anywhere else he might have tried to conceal himself. It didn't occur to any of us to check the rooms of the other patients. One of the nurses found him a few hours later, lying fully clothed and in the fetal position, on the floor of Bess's room. He was little more than alive. His eyes were barely dilatable, his muscles like steel rods. I recognized the symptoms immediately. There were two other patients exactly like him in Ward 3B. He was in a deep catatonic state. Prout was gone. Robert had stayed behind. I had rather expected something like this. What I failed to foresee, however, was that later that morning, Bess would also be reported missing. Giselle had the report translated by a cryptographer she knew, who used as a basis for this the Paxo version of Hamlet that Prout had done for me earlier, titled Preliminary Observations on B. Tick, RX-4987-165.233. It was primarily a detailed natural history of the Earth, especially of the recent changes thereon, which he attributed to man's cancerous population growth, his mindless consumption of its natural resources, and his catastrophic elevation of himself to superiority over all the other species who cohabit our planet. All of this is consistent with his use of capitals for the Earth and other planets, and lowercase for individual beings. There were also some suggestions as to how we might treat our social illnesses, the elimination of religion, capital, nationalism, the family as the basic social and educational unit, all the things he imagined were fundamentally wrong with us, and paradoxically, the things most of us hold dear. Without these adjustments, he wrote, the prognosis was not good. Indeed, he gave us only another decade to make the necessary changes. Otherwise, he concluded, human life on the planet Earth will not survive another century. His last four words were somewhat encouraging, however. They were, Oho mini blup kelsur. They are yet children. Epilogue. Robert's mother arrived with Giselle the day after Prout's departure and stayed through the weekend, but there was no indication whatever of cognizance on Robert's part. She was a lovely woman, a bit confused, of course, about what had happened to her son. From the beginning, she had been completely unaware of Prout's existence, as were we all. I told her there was no need for her to stay longer, and promised to let her know of any change in his condition. I dropped her at Newark Airport before heading for the Adirondacks with Chip, who tearfully admitted his cocaine problem when I confronted him with it, to join Karen and Bill and his wife and daughter. That was nearly 5 years ago. How I wish I could tell you that Robert sat up one fine day during that time and said, "I'm hungry. Got any fruit?" But despite our best efforts and constant attention, he remains to this day in a deep catatonic state. Like most catatonics, he probably hears every word we say, but refuses, or is unable, to respond. Perhaps with patience and kindness on our part, he will emerge, in time, from this tragic condition. Stranger things have happened. I have known patients who have returned to us after 20 years of sleep. In the meantime, we can do little more than wait. Giselle visits him almost every week, and we usually have lunch and talk about our lives. She is currently researching a book about the deplorable infant mortality rate in America. Her long report on mental illness, featuring Prout and some of the other patients, appeared in a special health-oriented issue of Conundrum. As a result of that piece, we have received thousands of letters from people asking for more information about KPACs, many of them wanting to know how they can get there. and a film director has requested authorization to do the story of Robert's life. I don't know whether anything will come of that, but thanks to Giselle's tireless efforts, the information we received from Robert's mother, the hours of conversations I had with Prout, and the cooperation of the authorities in Montana, we now have a reasonably clear picture of what happened on that terrible afternoon of August 16 through the early morning hours of August 17, 1985. First, some biographical details. Robert Porter was born in Guelph in 1957, the son of a slaughterhouse worker. Shortly after Robert's birth, his father became disabled when a convulsing steer became unhooked and fell on top of him. In terrible pain for the rest of his life, unable even to tolerate bright light, he spent many of his waking hours with his young son, an energetic, happy boy who liked books and puzzles and animals. He never recovered from his injuries and died when Robert was 6 years old. His father had often speculated on the possibility of remarkable life forms living among the stars in the sky, and Robert called into being a new friend from a faraway planet where people didn't die so readily. For the next several years, Robert suffered brief bouts of depression, at which times he usually called on Prout for comfort and support. But he was never hospitalized or otherwise treated for it. His mother took a job in the school cafeteria, which paid poorly, and the family, which also included two daughters, was barely able to make ends meet. Luxuries like fresh fruit were rare. Recreation took the form of hikes in the nearby woods and along the riverbank, and from these Robert gained a love and appreciation of the flora and fauna in forest and field, and, indeed, of the forests and fields themselves. He was a good student, always willing to pitch in and help others. In the fall of 1974, when he was a high school senior, Robert was presented a community service medal by the Guelph Rotary Club, and later that year was elected captain of the varsity wrestling team. In the spring of 1975, he was awarded a scholarship to the State University to study field biology. But his girlfriend, Sarah Barnstable, became pregnant, and Robert felt obligated to marry her and find work to support his new family. Ironically, the only job he could find was the same one that had killed his father 12 years earlier. To add to their difficulties, his wife was Catholic, and the resulting mixed marriage stigmatized the pair in the eyes of the residents of their small town, and they had few, if any, friends. This may have been a factor in their eventual decision to move to an isolated valley some miles outside of town. One August afternoon in 1985, while Robert was stunning steers at the slaughterhouse, an intruder appeared at the Porter house. Mother and daughter were in the backyard cooling themselves under the lawn sprinkler. The man, a stranger, who had been arrested and released numerous times for a variety of crimes, including burglary, automobile theft, and child molestation, entered the house through the unlocked front door and watched Sarah and little Rebecca from the kitchen window until the girl came inside, probably to use the bathroom. It was then that the intruder accosted her. Hearing her daughter's screams, the mother ran into the house, where both she and Rebecca were raped and murdered, though not before Sarah had severely scratched the intruder's face and nearly bitten off one of his ears. Robert arrived home just as the man was coming out of the house. On seeing the husband and father of his victims, the murderer ran back inside and out the rear door. Robert, undoubtedly realizing that something was terribly wrong, pursued him into the house, past the bloody bodies of his wife and daughter lying on the kitchen floor, and into the yard, where he caught up with their killer and, with the strength of a knocker and the skills of a trained wrestler, broke the man's neck. The sprinkler was still on and remained so until the police shut it off the next day. He then returned to the house, carried his wife and daughter to their bedrooms, covered them with blankets, washed and dried their swimsuits and put them away, mopped the bloody kitchen floor, and, after saying his final farewells, made his way to the nearby river, where he took off his clothes and jumped in an apparent suicide attempt. Although his body was never found, the police concluded that he had died by drowning, the case was officially closed, and that is how the report went into the files. He must have come ashore somewhere downstream, and from that point on he was no longer Robert, but Prot, derived presumably from Porter, who wandered around the country for 5 years before being picked up at the bus terminal in New York City. How he lived during that period is a complete mystery, but I suspect he spent a lot of time in public libraries, studying the geography and languages of the countries of the world, in lieu of actually visiting them. He probably slept there as well, though how he found food and clothing is anybody's guess. But who was Prot? And where did his bizarre idea of a world without government, without money, sex, or love come from? I submit that somehow this secondary personality was unconsciously able to utilize areas or functions of the brain that the rest of us, except perhaps those afflicted with savant syndrome and certain other disorders, cannot. Given that ability, he must have spent much of his time developing his concept of an idyllic world where all the events that had accumulated to ruin his friend Robert's life on Earth could not happen. His vision of this utopian existence was so intense and so complete that, over the years, he imagined it down to the most minute detail and in a language of his own creation. He even divined somehow the nature of its parent suns and the pattern of stars in the immediate vicinity, as well as those of several other planets he claimed to have visited. All the data he provided to Dr. Flynn and his associates have proven to be completely accurate. His ideal world had to be one in which fathers don't die while their children are growing up. Prot solved this problem in two ways. A Capaxian child rarely, if ever, sees his parents, or even knows who they are. At the same time, he is comforted by the knowledge that they will probably live to be 1,000. It had to be a world without sex, or even love, those very human needs which can destroy promising young lives and rewarding careers. More importantly, without love there can be no loss. Without sex, no sex crimes. A world without even water, which might be used for sprinkling lawns. There would be no currency of any kind in this idealized place, the need for which kept Robert out of college and forced him to spend his life destroying the animals he loved, the same kind of work that had killed his father. As a corollary, no animals would be slaughtered or otherwise exploited on his idyllic planet. His world would be one without God or any form of religion. Such beliefs had prevented Sarah from using birth control devices and then had stigmatized the mixed marriage in the eyes of the community. Without religion, such difficulties could never arise. He may also have reasoned that what happened to Robert's wife and child, and his father as well, argued against the existence of God. Finally, it had to be a world without schools, without countries, without governments or laws, all of which Prot saw as doing little, if anything, to solve Robert's personal and social problems. None of the beings on his idealized planet were driven by the forces of ignorance and greed that, in his eyes, motivate human beings here on Earth. I was puzzled at first by the question, given his intolerable situation, why didn't Robert move with his pregnant wife to another part of the state or country, both for work and to escape the local bigotry? It was Giselle, a small-town girl herself, who reminded me that young people all over America, trapped by family ties and economic need, accept jobs they abhor and stay put for the rest of their lives, benumbing themselves on their off hours with beer and sports and soap operas. But despite this dreary aspect, it is possible that without the terrible events of August 16th, 17th, 1985, Robert and his wife and daughter might have enjoyed a reasonably happy life together. They certainly maintained strong family ties, both with one another and with their respective kin. But something did happen that day, something so devastating as to deal the final blow to Robert's psyche. He called on his alter ego one last time to help him deal with that unspeakable horror. But this time Prot was unable to heal the wounds, at least not anywhere on Earth, where rape and murder are of no more consequence than last night's television shows. In Prot's mind, the only place where one could deny such horrible crimes was the imaginary world he had created, where violence and death are not a way of life. A beautiful planet called Cape Pax, where life is virtually free of pain and sorrow. He spent the next 5 years trying to convince Robert to go there with him. Instead, devastated by grief and guilt, he retreated farther and farther into his own inner world, where even Prout could not follow. Why Prout chose to return after exactly that period of time is unclear, particularly in view of the fact that his earlier visits were of much shorter duration. He may have realized that it would take considerable time to convince Robert to accompany him on his return, discovering finally that even the allotted 5 years wouldn't be enough. In any case, Prout did, indeed, depart this earth, for all practical purposes, at the appointed time, and Robert is still with us in Ward 3B. The staff and patients bring him fruit every day, and recently I brought in a Dalmatian puppy who never leaves his side except to go outside, all of which he ignores. Hoping to stimulate his curiosity, I tell him about all the new patients who have arrived over the past year or so, including a brand new Jesus Christ, whom Russell welcomed to Ward 2 with, "I was you once." Upon arrival, all of them are told the legend of K-Pax, which, along with the gossamer thread, brings smiles and hope and makes our job a little easier. I also keep Robert up to date on the activities of Ernie and Howie, both of whom have been released and are leading highly productive lives. Ernie as a city-employed counselor for the homeless, and Howie as a violinist with a New York-based chamber ensemble. The former, who until recently had never even kissed a woman for fear of contamination, is now engaged to be married. Both stop by MPI frequently to say hello to me and to Robert, and Howie has performed for the patients and staff on a number of occasions. I've told him also about the wedding of Chuck and Mrs. Archer, who are happily sharing a room in Ward 2, not because they have to remain on that ward, but because they choose to wait there for Prout's return. Mrs. A., who is no longer called the Duchess, looks much younger now, but I'm not sure whether it's because of the marriage or her giving up smoking. And about their adopting Maria, who has moved into a convent in Queens and is the happiest novice out there. She is totally free of headaches and insomnia, and none of her secondary identities have put in an appearance since she left the hospital. Russell comes to pray with Robert daily. He has recovered completely from the surgical removal of a golf ball-sized tumor in his colon, and so far there has been no sign of a recurrence. Ed is doing well, too. There have been few violent episodes since Prout's departure, all minor, and he has been transferred to Ward 2. He spends most of his time working in the flower garden with La Belle Chat. All of them are waiting patiently for Prout's return and the journey to K-Pax, except for Wacky, who was recently reunited with his former fiancée when her husband was returned to prison for a lengthy stay. To my knowledge, no one has told Robert about this, but perhaps, as Prout undoubtedly would have, he just knows. Perhaps he knows also that Mrs. Trexler is retired now. On my recommendation, she has been seeing a psychoanalyst, and she tells me she is more at peace with herself than she has been in decades. And that Betty McAllister became pregnant shortly after Prout's departure and is now the mother of triplets. Whether Prout had anything to do with this, I can't say. Of course, I've also told him about my daughter Abby's new job. Now that her kids are both in school, as editor of the Princeton-based Animal Rights Forum, Prout would have liked that. And about Jenny, now a resident in internal medicine at Stanford, who plans to stay in California to work with AIDS patients in the San Francisco area. Her sexual preference and disinclination to produce grandchildren for us seems of microscopic importance compared to her dedication to helping others, and I am very proud of her. As I am of Freddie, who is appearing at the time of this writing in a Broadway musical. He lives in Greenwich Village with a beautiful young ballerina, and we've seen a lot more of him in the last year than in all those he was an airline pilot combined. But I'm proudest of all of Will, who has taken an interest in Bill and Eileen Siegel's daughter and calls her every day, much to the delight of the phone company. I have brought him to the hospital once or twice to show him what his old man does for a living, but when he met Giselle, he decided he wanted to become a journalist. We are very close now, much more so than I was with Fred and the girls. For that, as with so many other things, I have Prout to thank. And, of course, I brag about my two grandsons, whom I get to see quite often. They are Shasta's favorite visitors, and who are the smartest and nicest kids I have ever known, with the possible exception of my own children. I'm proud of all of them. I gave up the chairmanship to Klaus Villers, despite his decree limiting the number of cats and dogs in the hospital to 6 per floor. He is doing a far better job than I ever could have done, now unencumbered by all administrative duties and the talk show and as much of the other extraneous baggage as possible. I spend my working hours with my patients, and most of my free time with my family. I no longer sing at the hospital Christmas party, but my wife insists I continue to do so in the shower. She says she can't sleep otherwise. We both know I'm no Ezio Pinza, but I still think I sound a lot like him, and perhaps that's all that matters. I wish I could tell Robert that Bess is all right, but she has never turned up, nor have the flashlight, mirror, box of souvenirs, etc., and we have no idea as to her whereabouts. If you see a young black woman with a pretty face, perhaps sitting on a park bench hugging herself and rocking, please help her if you can, and let us know where she is. And, of course, I dearly wish I could tell him where his friend Prout is gone. I have played for him all the tapes of our sessions together, but there is no sign of comprehension on his part. I tell him to wait a little longer, that Prout has promised to return. He hears all this, curled up on his cot like some chrysalis, without batting an eye, and perhaps he understands. Will Prout ever show up again? And how did he get from his room to Bess's under our very noses? Did this involve a kind of hypnosis on his part, or a similar ability we don't comprehend? We may never know. I fervently wish I could talk with him again, just for a little while, to ask him all the questions I never got the chance to ask before. I still think we could have learned a great deal more from Prout and, perhaps, from all our patients. As the cures to many of our physical ailments may be waiting for us in the rainforests, so may the remedies for our social ills lie in the deepest recesses of our minds. Who knows what any of us could do if we were able to concentrate our thoughts with Prout's degree of intensity, or if we simply had sufficient willpower? Could we, like him, see ultraviolet light if we wanted to badly enough, or fly, or outgrow our childhood and create a better world for all the inhabitants of the earth? Perhaps he will return someday. By his own calculations, he's due again soon. Giselle, who has been waiting patiently for him, has no doubts whatsoever, nor do any of the patients, nor most of the staff, who keep his dark glasses on a little dresser beside Robert's bed. And sometimes at night, I go out and look up at the sky, toward the constellation Lyra, and I wonder. Acknowledgements. I am indebted to many individuals for their generous assistance, especially John Davis for helpful discussions, and Burton H. Brody, Rhea Wilmshurst, C. A. Silber, and Robert Brewer for critical readings of the manuscript. I also thank my editors, Robert Wyatt and Iris Bass, for their excellent advice, Ida Girigoshian for suggesting I give them a try, and my agent, Maya Gregory, for her wit and timely encouragement, and, as always, my wife, Karen, for her unflagging support of everything I have ever done.
We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of K-Pax by Gene Brewer. Copyright 1995 by Gene Brewer. Read by Tom Casaletto. Performance copyright 1995 by Brilliance Audio. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, Post Office Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.